I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. What is a social entrepreneur? We have two answers for you on today's show. First, we'll speak with Dan Biederman. He's the co-founder of the Bryant Park Corporation in New York, a private organization that transformed Bryant Park in the center of the city from a dangerous and depressing eyesore to one of the best-loved and most intensely used urban parks in the world. We'll also speak with Pamela Hartigan. She's the founding director of Volans, a venture company dedicated to social innovation. She's written a book about social entrepreneurs called The Power of Unreasonable People. All that, plus our City Views commentator Walker Smith, and the latest from PlanetiZen's Nate Berg, coming up after the news on Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Bryant Park is a 9-acre public park in New York City. In the 70s and 80s, it had a bad reputation, no, a terrible reputation, as a dangerous place to go. But Dan Biederman changed all that. He's the co-founder of the Bryant Park Corporation and the Grand Central Partnership and the 34th Street Partnership, all business improvement districts in New York. And in his role at the Bryant Park Corporation, he turned the park from a no-go zone to one of the most popular urban parks in the world. What a pleasure it is to talk with the person who gave us such a wonderful, wonderful public space as Bryant Park in New York City. What was your original vision for Bryant Park?
Well, one of the first things I did when I was hired was to look for models, and we looked at Rockefeller Center in New York, which pleased a lot of people, and the public spaces around the Rouse facilities in Boston and Baltimore, and also Disney. Even though it was private and you had to pay to get in, they were clearly pleasing a lot of people. So the vision really was get rid of all the bad things in the park at the time, drugs, graffiti, crime, serious crime. There were murders and rapes and robberies there galore. And make the park clean and safe, and then program it. And the vision was a new town square for Midtown Manhattan right at the heart of the Central Business District.
What was it you learned from these models that you studied at Disney and Rouse and Rockefeller Center?
They clearly paid a lot of attention to detail. Retail was not a bad thing to put in urban spaces. There was much unhappiness when we proposed that we would do some food retail in Bryant Park, but it only occupies less than 5% of all the total land. And programming, things to make people come to the park, even in weather that's not perfect, because you have very few perfect weather days in Bryant Park. You might have 30 or 40 each year where the weather's just exquisite. You got to keep your clientele coming back when it's a little warmer or when there's a wind and it's a little cool in the fall. So we program very carefully based on some of the things we learned from other places. But obviously, we've been running this park now for 18 years, so we've learned a lot and we've come up with a lot of new ideas ourselves.
What are the most important things you've learned about running a successful park that others can learn from?
First thing is your female customer is your most important customer. If you please women, you will please everyone, because women note dirt and they know danger much more than males do. Males will sit down next to a dangerous person and not even notice. Males will sit down with litter and the like. So we said we can't have that. We also have to have very good restrooms for them because they let us know that. So we made the park exquisitely clean. And we made the restrooms unusually luxurious and well-managed and clean. And we picked up paper, frequently eliminated any traces of graffiti, and then programmed with events that would draw female clientele, whether it's the arts or literature. Horticulture is an important part of the park, too. And we have a special appeal to gardeners. There are 67 million amateur gardeners in the United States, and we seem to have good portion of them because they ask us questions about the flowers we have.
What have been your biggest challenges?
Well, to get it going, politics was the big challenge. New York is not a city that's friendly to private management, or the word privatization is almost a dirty word here. So, and what we were proposing was to take this park out of the public sector and move it into the private to some extent. We still New York City land, but it's really run by a private corporation. So that was the initial challenge. The challenge since has been to react to events occasionally, different mayors, still some politics, but also to keep it fresh. We really have made a great effort to keep the park complex, evolving, improving each year. We've done that with new programs, with new ideas from elsewhere that we see, new ideas we generate. And one of my joys now is to go into the park and be behind a person who's explaining to a visitor how the park works. And it takes them a while. They wave their arms. They point in different directions. They say, let me explain to you what happens over there normally. They're not there today, but normally there's this and that. So it's really terrific that the park is a complex experience that people feel that they haven't gotten the hang of yet, and they keep coming back for more.
What do you mean by keeping the park complex?
As you walk on one of the paths, you will see an ever-changing group of events. You might see one day just a simple reading room, which is something no one else does, but we pioneered it. It's an outdoor library, in effect, in the park, and you can borrow the books and sit there and read magazines, newspapers, and the like. The next day, the library will still be there, but there will be an event with a well-known author who is describing his or her book and signing copies of it, just as might happen in a Barnes & Noble or a Borders. A little on beyond that, and there's some chess players who have made a little enclave for themselves under a certain tree, and there are six or eight different speed chess games going on, and they move around. And further, you're getting to the area where most people are on the web access system, Wi-Fi, where they're doing work, and they've stayed out of their office and decided to stay longer in the afternoon because it's a nice day. So you've got all kinds of little things going on that change, and we work incredibly carefully to make sure these details appeal, so that this will be the town center for the business district, and therefore the crowds are very large.
Dan, how do you manage physical encroachments on the park? How many are too many? I was there a few weeks ago during Fashion Week and couldn't get into the park. So how do you know when too much is indeed too much?
We don't have too many of them, first, Carol. And second, the city has agreed with us that eventually, because the Fashion Week has grown so much, it's a wonderful event, but they need a bigger space and a more established flat, hard surface to be underneath them. So eventually they will find another home for it quite soon, we hope. That's really the only event of its kind. The most of the other events that have any kind of private tinge to them are mostly concerts and the like, in film series paid for by private parties, where a promotion of a product might be incidental, but the main thing is the public's being entertained. Fashion is not open to the public, but there really aren't many of them. And by the way, while they're there, a large part of the park is still open to the public, and people just move their operations from the lawn to the surrounding, what we call LAs, where the trees are. And they operate in chairs and tables underneath the trees, much as they would if the lawn were open to them.
Why couldn't the city do Bryant Park on its own?
Well, the city people are actually quite smart and have emulated a number of things we've done. At the time we took Bryant Park over, the city was just coming out of its fiscal crisis. So it was a question partly of resources. Partly, they had 1,500 other parks, and it's hard to, when you've got such a big empire, to pay as much attention to a few of them. We subsequently went on and did two others, Herald and Greeley Squares, down at 34th Street as part of our BID there. So we only run three of roughly now, I think, 1,700 parks in their empire. So it's a matter of focus and closeness to the customer, because we really know the people who surround the park, who would use it. We get support from their companies. So for a lot of reasons, it would have been hard for the city to do it exactly as we did. But the city, to its credit, has really emulated our techniques, and they've come up with a lot of their own, and they've done a very nice job in several other parks that serve business districts.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Dan Biederman. He is co-founder of the Bryant Park Corporation and a number of other business improvement districts in New York City. You've now developed business improvement districts in cities around the country. What makes a business improvement district work?
Much the same as with parks that we've done. BIDs allow the business community to focus on the things that they know to be wrong with their neighborhood and put added resources into them that they can control through a small board of directors rather than going through the city's budget process. So a building will pay anywhere from a few $100 a year to several $100,000 a year into a fund managed by what's called a business improvement district, with a director like me who will spend that money on enhanced services and then some programs that the city would not think of providing because it's beyond their scope given their cost base. We've done that at 34th Street and Grand Central in New York. now in Chelsea on a more informal basis, not technically a BID. We were early. We weren't the first, but it's been copied in many, many places. The budgets range from as little as a couple hundred thousand dollars a year to as much as 12 or 14 million a year.
If business improvement districts or BIDs work so well, why doesn't the city just turn over all of its parks to BIDs?
Well, there are many of the city's parks are in neighborhoods that wouldn't allow that. The bulk of the assets in those neighborhoods are not big enough to pay for much added service. That's one thing. Second, there are residential district parks, and the city, for its own reasons, I don't agree with them, has traditionally discouraged districts being created in residential neighborhoods. They are called business improvement districts, and they've taken that at the city council to mean that they shouldn't encourage the growth of these in residential neighborhoods. And I would say at least 3/4 of the city's parks are really in residential districts rather than business districts. So for all those reasons, there are only a few parks that benefit from BID expenditures.
Are there things you can do, Dan, that you know you can do that will most assuredly lead to higher real estate values?
Well, you start, as we did, with clean and safe. And that's become a mantra for most BIDs in the country. We've gone way beyond that because our third keyword was words were capital plant. We looked at the capital plant and Grand Central Partnership when we worked there, and we said the city has not invested in this capital plant in decades. We need to fix it. So we replaced every single thing: lampposts, signs, trees, corners, newspaper boxes. And that was all with privately raised money through a bond issue backed by the credit of the Business Improvement District. It was those things that really turned the neighborhood around. We've gone on to add 5, 6, 8 other programs, but that's a good way to start. Clean, safe, and attractive. And attractiveness applies not only to the storefronts, but also to the public realm, as we call it, which includes all those capital improvements.
Are there times when a business improvement district just doesn't work?
Yeah, I'd say the cases where districts don't work include not enough money, not the right leadership, board battles, sometimes too much interference by the city. That happened here. It's happened in many other cities. I'd say there are plenty of districts where they're not achieving as much as they might. Interestingly, though, the property owners usually vote to continue them. So they feel the situation with the districts is better than it was before they started.
How do you work out the relationships between the BID and the city? You've talked about the mayor's office, but what about the city departments like police and sanitation in particular?
The line agencies tend to be easy to work with, police and sanitation, yeah. There isn't a large amount of jealousy or unhappiness. They've got their hands full with all kinds of crises, and they're happy to have the help. Agencies that involve design are usually tougher. Our relationship with the Department of Transportation in New York City is up and down. It's currently up. We have a commissioner who's pushing through a lot of pedestrian and green type initiatives very quickly and is happy to work with us. And this is the most productive relationship we've ever had with them. But there are times when highway engineers and sign specialists in the agency can be reluctant to work with the business improvement districts.
You mentioned earlier that you put together the Chelsea Improvement Company to redevelop the public realm and the block surrounding Chelsea Market. What opportunity did you see there, and what opportunity did the owners see there for private management of the public realm?
Well, it's a fascinating district. It's about 20 blocks from the center of Midtown Manhattan, but in Southwest Chelsea you had some very interesting retail. And Chelsea Market is a fascinating building cobbled together from 14 individual small buildings by a very creative property owner, Irwin Cohen, back about a decade ago. The problem was, outside those buildings, it still looked like the manufacturing district it used to be. And you had situations where people would be there at night enjoying the 4 new classy restaurants that are there, walking on totally dark streets and not knowing where they were going. These are 25-year-old women in stiletto heels, all dressed up, ready to go to a club. And we said, you know, this is a dangerous situation because as dark as can be here, and people are eventually going to know there's an opportunity. So even though street crime is not a big issue in New York anymore, we saw a potential for some of it down there. So we had to start just as we did up in Midtown further, picking up litter, removing all the graffiti, increasing the light levels, adding some security, and working on the parks and public spaces. And now an entirely new streetscape being proposed to the city. They haven't agreed to it all yet. We're having trouble, as we did with Grand Central and 34th Street, pushing it slowly through the regulatory procedures. But we'll get there, I think.
Why would the city resist improved streets?
There are design review agencies in the city that have their own views about separate vocabularies of streetscape from those put out on the street by the city of New York. So that's one of the principal issues. And then some of the Department of Transportation people have their own ideas about how this stuff ought to look. So it's not unfriendly. It's just different views have to be reconciled to get all our stuff approved and out there.
What's in it for the city to allow business improvement districts?
Mainly added service without any cost to the taxpayers or any further drain on the managerial resources of the city. So they usually do cooperate very well. As I said, there have been cases where city managers or mayors have terminated BIDs, not cooperated with them, interfered in the management of day-to-day. But generally, across the country, it's been a pretty positive picture.
Explain the difference between a BID, a business improvement district, and a TIF, a tax increment financing option.
Well, BIDs, it's an add-on charge to real estate tax charges placed on any individual building. And you can choose to build capital improvements based on the ongoing stream of revenue. Very few districts have done that. We've been 4 out of the 5, I think, that have been done in the country that way. TIFs are totally different. That's commitment by the city to assign any added taxes that come in as a result of a new development project, not to the general revenue of that city, but to building improvements that will encourage that development to be successful. So that can be streetscape, it can be park, highway expenditures, and TIFs have been very, very big in Illinois. They don't work at all in New York. There's never been a successful TIF that I'm aware of in New York State. So it's amazing how the states differ.
Have you done research that shows changes in surrounding real estate value as a result of a business improvement district?
Our best piece on that is a park-based piece of research. The accounting firm Ernst & Young did a very solid piece based on analysis of asking rents in the Bryant Park neighborhood versus other pieces of the city during a period from 1991 to actually early 00s, and showed huge increases in asking rents and therefore value created by the presence of Bryant Park. And all you need to back that up with anecdotal experience is look at the real estate ads, which inevitably say just steps from Bryant Park, overlooking Bryant Park. This is the last thing people wanted to boast about 20 years ago when the park was still lousy. But things are being named after us all over the place, a hotel, a restaurant, an office building that's the biggest green building in the United States, One Bryant Park, put up by the Durst family with Bank of America. So in addition to making people want to simply live there more, there's real and work there. There's more brand equity from the name Bryant Park than you can imagine.
Dan, you received the Manhattan Institute's first Lifetime Achievement Award for social entrepreneurship. You've done such a wonderful job with parks and public improvements in the city of New York. Are there other problem areas in the public realm that you'd like to tackle where you see an opportunity for innovation?
Yeah, I would. I view social entrepreneurship differently than many others, including actually they teach it at Harvard Business School where I went, but they teach a different version of it than I believe in. I think social entrepreneurship is taking business techniques from the private sector and applying them to public problems. Sometimes social entrepreneurship is just defined as people who've decided to be innovative in the nonprofit sector. I don't think that's social entrepreneurship. So the most promising routes, I think, in the country to develop social entrepreneurship are with operations that the public sector has written off as economically feasible. Example, the old saw that every mass transit can never break even or make money. It's complete nonsense, but it doesn't right now. Why? Because every mass transit agency in the country is run by the public sector, and the public sector overpays on the expense side and undercharges very often on the revenue side. I could give you examples of that. So naturally, the profit and loss statement shows a huge deficit. And then the image gets created that mass transit always has to lose money. It doesn't. It could be run by the private sector at a wash or better. even after an investment in improved facilities, but that it's a very hard case to make because it's been decades and decades of the old views of this being accepted.
Dan, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City and for the work you do in New York.
Thank you very much.
Dan Biederman is the president of the Bryant Park Corporation. He joined us from his office in New York City, and his interview was engineered by Amber Cortez. For the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we go to PlanEdison assistant editor Nate Berg.
Home values in the U.S. are on a steep slide. This fall in prices has put millions of Americans underwater or owing more on their mortgages than their homes are worth. A recent article from MSNBC says that nearly one out of every six Americans has more to pay on their home than that home could sell for today. This has had a feedback effect on the economy, with spending plummeting nationwide. And with more and more homeowners underwater, many fear more foreclosures will follow and property values will dip even lower. The federal government's financial bailout plan is expected to have some positive impact on the situation, but it may be a year or more before home values for those millions of Americans rise back above how much they still owe on their houses. And the downturn in the economy is being felt hardest among Americans with low incomes, and not just because of falling home values. As a recent article from the Wall Street Journal discusses, nonprofit hospitals have been closing their doors in urban areas and leaving their low-income clientele with few options for health care. Nonprofit hospital groups like Ascension Health primarily offer services to the, quote, poor and vulnerable. But because those poor and vulnerable are often uninsured, the cost of providing services has gotten incredibly high in urban areas. So hospitals are doing the logical thing. They're closing shop in the cities and moving out to the suburbs, where people are more likely to have insurance. With fewer inner-city facilities, people in low-income areas like downtown Detroit are having to search for new hospitals. But with low incomes and no insurance, what they find may not be as welcoming as the now-departed nonprofit hospitals. And finally, despite recent press about the suburbs being abandoned, some suburban areas are still drawing development and people. One example is the suburban Houston town of Fulshear, where local officials are expecting huge subdivision developments to pop up over the next two decades. With some major housing projects already underway, the small town of just 716 people is expected to grow into a city of more than 40,000 within 15 years. Fulshear residents are mixed on the growth, but officials see this as an opportunity. As the Houston Chronicle reports, local officials are not going to let this growth catch them by surprise. In order to absorb growth gracefully, officials have enacted land use plans and regulatory ordinances more typically used in larger cities. As Fulshear goes from burg to boomtown, one planning commissioner says, quote, "We're definitely aware that we could get run over with development." Residents are hoping that local planners are up to the task. For PlanEdison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after a short break, we'll speak with Pamela Hardigan. Her book, The Power of Unreasonable People, outlines what a social entrepreneur is and the difficulties faced when you want to change the world. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. And for our podcast listeners, we have a special message. Here's our producer, Scotty Iseri.
Hi, Carol. How's it going?
It's always going great.
The show is going well so far?
Well, that's for the listener to decide.
Well, speaking of our listeners, we have this really great base of podcast listeners, right? We have thousands of people that download our show every week. They come to our site, they click on the link, and they download our show, and they can take Smart City with them wherever we go. And we often get really great comments and feedback from them on our site. So we thought, why don't we create a site for our podcast listeners? It's called My City. It's got forums. It's a social networking site strictly for the listeners of Smart City.
Well, I think it would be fun to get to know the listeners better, because it's really, in a way, it's like getting to know the people we interview better. We're all in this together. We're all trying to learn how to make cities more successful, our own cities more successful. So I'd love to hear what listeners have to say, and I'd love to learn more about what they're doing, the experiences they're having, what they see that's interesting, exciting, fun, cutting edge in their cities, some of which I'd love to turn into interviews.
Exactly, and that's what My City is all about. So what I'm asking the podcast listeners to do is email me, my personal email, I'm giving this out, and I'll send you an invite, join our social networking site, join My City, and make My City your city. It's Scotty, S-C-O-T-T-Y, at smartcityradio.com.
We look forward to hearing from you. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Pamela Hardigan has had a long history in social change. She was the managing director of the Schwab Foundation, a Swiss-based organization focused on advancing the practice of social entrepreneurship. She's now founded Volans, a venture company dedicated to growing and sustaining innovative solutions to the world's economic, social, and environmental challenges, from poverty and disease to the loss of biodiversity and accelerating climate change. In between all that, she's written a book, The Power of Unreasonable People. The book is a business manifesto showcasing some of the brightest minds who are working to change the world. Pamela, you've written a book about the power of unreasonable people. What do you mean by unreasonable?
Basically, that title comes from the quote by George Bernard Shaw, who was an Irish playwright. What he said was, the reasonable man or woman adapts him or herself to the way the world is, whereas the unreasonable person refuses to accept the way the world is and tries to change it so that it's more in keeping with his or her values. Therefore, any hope of progress depends on the unreasonable person. And because of the fact that we're writing about entrepreneurial individuals who set up organizations that set out to create systemic social change, we really found that that title or that quote fit very well the kinds of people and organizations we were talking about. It's proven to be very much the case.
What do you mean by systemic social change?
What I mean by that is that there are an awful lot of things in the world today that are creating a disequilibrium, if you wish, between the haves and the have-nots, whether it's in the area of environment or in the area of education or healthcare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these are all parts of the way our systems and our societies have been set up to function. And most of us get by with those systems and kind of put up with the absurdities of the way society has structured some of these aspects here in the U.S., healthcare, et cetera. It doesn't need much more elaboration than that. And these entrepreneurs, these are entrepreneurs because they see an opportunity and they're extremely resourceful and innovative and creative. They set about to really change that inequity or change that disequilibrium to create a completely different way of doing things. If we look, of course, at the typical, I guess, the story that most people know in the area of banking and finance, where 30 years ago or even, you know, more recently, if you were poor and had no collateral, you could not get credit. You could not get a loan. And we know that in 2006, Muhammad Yunus from Bangladesh won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in microfinance, which basically completely changed the vision that the poor were not credit worthy. He showed, in fact, that the poor were far more credit worthy than most middle or wealthy people, that if you lent to the poor, you would get your money back. Of course, he spawned a completely new industry, which is the industry of microfinance, which today mainstream banking institutions are interested in pursuing. That definitely created a systemic change and created a completely different way of looking at a population.
The term social entrepreneur, of course, is very popular today, but what's the difference really between a social entrepreneur and an inspired nonprofit or business leader other than the nomenclature?
These people are entrepreneurs, and entrepreneurs basically identify opportunities to set up a new way of doing things, a new market, provide a new product, a new service that completely transforms the way things have been in the past. If you look at Bill Gates with Microsoft or Google, et cetera, et cetera. The difference between the business and the social entrepreneur is really in the fact that the business entrepreneur sets out to create something where there is a market for that particular thing that they're creating, whereas the social entrepreneur isn't interested in the profit-making aspect because, in fact, they're creating a system where the people that they're setting out to serve usually are people who cannot pay a market rate for that good or service or that product. And so they are really looking at how much social impact. Social impact is really their barometer for change. Now, the difference between, say, a charity and a social enterprise is really that most charities set up to provide a palliative service, and they're extremely important. I have to add, they're a fundamental component of our society because they do provide some form of alleviation for those whose society has not benefited. So if you set up a hospital, say, that's terrific. But the entrepreneur wants to completely revise the healthcare system, not just set up a hospital to provide the service. I don't know if that's a clear definition. You know, instead of constructing a school, let's completely revise the education system, which, you know, something like Teach for America has set out to do in this country.
You say that that social impact is the barometer of change for a social entrepreneur. And, of course, measuring the social impact of various efforts is a very challenging thing to do. What ways are social entrepreneurs using to really measure the results of their work?
It really depends on what they've set out to do. If you take, for example, a social enterprise like, say, Kickstart, which has set out to create a middle class in African society, what they are doing is they are selling appropriate technologies to poor farmers that will allow them to generate more jobs, greater income, et cetera, and really transform the landscape of poverty in those specific countries where they're working. What they're monitoring is how many new jobs are we creating? What is the change in the lives of the people that we are actually benefiting? How many tools are we actually selling? And how many people are these people who are buying our tools employing? The metrics of by which each one is going to measure is going to depend very much on what their mission is. The thing, as you point out, which as you allude to, is that unlike business enterprises, which can certainly measure by, you know, profits, this is not the case in social entrepreneurship where there is no common benchmark such as the dollar.
Are there social entrepreneurs operating in a for-profit model?
Yes. As a matter of fact, this is a fascinating area for me because in the United States, because there is a wealth, probably the United States is the most philanthropic from the point of view of foundations and the money that is given philanthropically, country in the world. That has a funny and almost paradoxical effect, which is as follows. When an entrepreneur who wants to change a system that's causing a disequilibrium in the society wants to set out to do that, they usually decide to go the not-for-profit route because philanthropic funds for startups are much more readily available than in other places. But in other countries where that tradition of philanthropy does not exist, where such an entrepreneur has a burning passion and an innovative idea, they are almost forced to think creatively about how are they going to sustain financially the social mission of that organization. And so they have to create the organization to be able to generate some sort of financial income. But the income, rather than being distributed among shareholders, is actually reinvested in growing the social mission of the organization. And we find examples across the world of that.
What are the characteristics that successful social entrepreneurs share?
Well, as alluding back to the title of the book, most people think they're completely insane when they start out. They see an opportunity where everybody else is seeing a problem. And whereas most of us will say, oh, it can't be done, they're the, you know, as one of them has said to me, just say no, and that's sort of the battle cry. They're extremely persistent. They're courageous. They don't see risks. They only see opportunities. They are, I would say, almost some of them describe themselves as they have an attention deficit disorder, meaning that they're not linear thinkers. They're not the folks that you're going to find within the consulting firms like McKinsey or Boston Consulting, et cetera, who have a very linear and focused approach to a problem. Entrepreneurs in general, business or social, are very lateral in their thinking. So they see connections where none of us really sees connections, which is part of their creative and innovative bent. I think that one of the things that's fascinated me about them is they never wait for the resources to actually go out and get something done. They don't sit around waiting for the grant. They've actually started pushing through what they want to do before, independent of the resources at hand. And I think the real role of the social entrepreneur is to infect others around him or her, because one of the problems with social entrepreneurship as it's thought of today is it really highlights the individual. And in fact, we know that individuals make change happen, but it's also essential that they infect and they get other people around them to really believe in their vision. And it's often the people within that organization that entrepreneur creates or around them that really succeeds in making the change sustainable. Because on their own, these people, of course, are on their own. And there is a mix of talents, of course, that goes into making anything sustainable. So I like to think of the entrepreneur sort of as the catalyst or the person who identifies the opportunity, but with an army of those around them that then become entrepreneurial in the way they're approaching the problem, too, because they end up believing that they, too, can make that change happen.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Pamela Hardigan. She's the author of the book, The Power of Unreasonable People, about the different ways social entrepreneurs are using for-profit models to achieve not-for-profit goals. You've been in this field for some time, not just as an author, but also in your foundation work at Schwab Foundation. You've mentioned some of the best-known social entrepreneurs as you've been talking, but I'm curious who you've run across that may be unknown to the general public, but who you think really exemplifies the qualities of a great social entrepreneur.
Oh, there are just so many, you know. Okay, a couple. I can talk about one that has always just moved me completely, which is Cristóbal Colón in Spain. That his name is actually Christopher Columbus in Spanish. I don't know why his parents would have ever called him something like that. But he grew up in Spain, and he became a psychiatrist, and he worked in mental institutions. And he was very unhappy with the way these institutions were run and the way these patients were being treated, very much like people who were mentally deficient. Whereas he understood that mental illness isn't about being mentally deficient. It's just about being imbalanced in some way. In these institutions, oftentimes what they do is they give specific tasks to the mentally ill, whether they're schizophrenic or, you know, whatever illness they have, that is a task that usually is about, you know, making something that nobody will buy or, you know, only a mother could love, something like what your child makes at camp. And he became convinced that the way of really giving these people dignity was to create a place where what these people were working towards was something that people would want to buy. And what he created was a dairy farm, which produces one of the best yogurts in Spain. It's a for-profit organization, and it's what we call a social business, where the profits are reinvested in terms of growing the social mission. It employs the mentally ill, you know, manic depressives, schizophrenics, psychotics, etc., and those people who can come on and actually do a specific area of work in the dairy farm. So about two-thirds of the people in the dairy farm are mentally ill. And the interesting thing is that most people in Spain at the time when we discovered him had no idea that La Fajeda is the name of the enterprise, was actually employing the mentally ill. They just loved the yogurt. They didn't buy the yogurt because they felt sorry for the people that were working there. So I think it's a wonderful story of how, you know, we would have never thought that you could creating a business is tough enough, but creating a business and employing the people that nobody will employ is completely insane. I mean, excuse the pun, but he has done that and become, you know, it's you don't get rich by doing this, but his company has about a 10 million euro turnover a year, and he works very closely with the Ministry of Health and the different institutions in the health field who refer these people who are apt for this kind of work to them. And they have installed also, you know, psychiatric care, et cetera, on the premises of the farm. So I think that that's just an incredible story of how, you know, somebody has set out to do something that anybody would have said was completely unreasonable and impossible. Other ones, there's a young French entrepreneur named Olivier Desurmont, who set out to find a biodegradable solution for washing cars that did not use water. And again, he quit his job at Suez, which is one of the largest multinationals in the area of water, ironically enough, because he became so concerned about the scarcity of water worldwide and focusing on his native France, how many millions of liters of water were wasted simply by washing cars. And so he finally got one company to agree to help search for this biodegradable solution to see if it could actually work. And he tells the story of finally one company agreeing to do this and coming up with a solution. And then he would go about, he went to different car companies and car rental companies to basically sell the product, but also services. And the services were being delivered by people who were unemployable. So they were the ones, you know, the people who were hardcore unemployed. He would train them so that they were washing the cars with this biodegradable solution. And he says that in order to convince his customers initially, he had to drink the solution to prove that it was 100% biodegradable.
Oh, so, that's taking one for the cause.
I know, exactly. So that's a for-profit social business, again, which reinvests everything. And he's got the IP, the intellectual property, you know, patented the solution. And he franchises the entire model to those who want to, number one, employ the hardcore unemployed, and number two, do something about arresting the waste of water through car washing.
Wow. Those are two fabulous examples, very inspirational. Let me ask you something, Pamela. I know that you've started a venture company to focus on scalable solutions. This notion of scalability seems to stand in the way of many entrepreneurial ventures, not just social entrepreneurs. What is the key to being able to scale something effectively, especially when you've got this wonderful entrepreneur who's so passionate and his or her passion sort of infects the organization, but ultimately, you know, if you get big enough, things stand in between the entrepreneur's passion and, you know, who's standing at the end of the line.
You know, it's such a tough nut to crack. And we find is many of them get stuck, just as you imply, at a certain stage of their evolution. And sometimes it is the entrepreneur that is the problem. Again, the referring back to the organization and the kinds, you know, the person who comes in and starts the whole thing and infects the others isn't necessarily the person who's going to take it to scale. If you look at any of these organizations, the big ones, if you look at Microsoft or Google, et cetera, they've had to bring in the talent in order to be able to grow the company. And that is something that if you have the resources to do it, then you're very lucky. But as you can see from the two examples that I gave, although they are for profit and people are dying to engage with them. If you are an organization that can't pay market rates for the kind of talent that you need, it's much, much harder to do that, because I'm ultimately convinced that the growth of these organizations depends also on forming a mix of alliances. Certainly in the social entrepreneurial sector, the alliance between the for-profit large companies and the entrepreneurial creative social venture is fundamental. And many large companies are looking for those kinds of co-venturing opportunities because they're also searching for new markets. And because big companies aren't very good at being flexible or innovative or knowing how to venture into markets where the models that they've been using basically don't fit the kind of consumer, they really do need to find these alliances with those that can help them understand those markets and how to be sensitive to the dynamics of that particular population so that they're not just seeing these people as consumers, but also perhaps as providing, a supply, being supply chain or distribution chains.
Through your venture company, are you helping make these alliances?
That's exactly what we're doing.
That should be your next book.
Well, that's...
How to form good alliances.
You know, it really is a personal thing. It's so funny. People try to nail it down to kind of a 1-2-3 step. And it's so much about personalities. And it really is about it being open-minded and realizing that if you're going to have to form an alliance, you have to, you know, walk a mile in the other person's shoes. It can't just be about what you want. There has to be a way of really combining a situation so that there is a benefit for everybody who's involved. And I think one of the most interesting opportunities right now, or one of the most interesting examples of this, is an example that has been formed, a co-venture with the Danone Group, which is, of course, one of the largest food companies in the world, based out of France, and the Grameen Group, which, of course, we know is founded by Mohamed Yunus. And what they've done is created a co-venture, equal partnership, to come up with a yogurt that is affordable for the poorest of the poor and is also fortified so that it's dealing with the nutritional deficits of a large part of the population in Bangladesh. And it has forced Danone to rethink its entire business model and its entire model of how do you set up the factory where you produce this, what kind of distribution chain, because, of course, they can't do the refrigeration that they're used to having. They have to set up a completely different mechanism because of these power outages in Bangladesh that are so frequent. It's very difficult to have, you know, large refrigeration mechanisms. And so they have to produce a yogurt that basically goes from the factory into the kid's stomach within 24 hours and doesn't go bad. So there were all kinds of very interesting aspects that Danone had to rethink, which have brought enormous benefits to its own bottom line, including searching for a biodegradable cup. And Yunus is insisting that it be edible as well and also nutritious. So,
wow. Well, let me ask you again, you've been in this business a while. In doing the research for this book, did you find any surprises?
I didn't find any surprises. The thing that delights me is how excited people are by, in today's world where everything seems so disastrous, how excited people are by these kinds of possibilities. There is an author, an entrepreneur who wrote a book that I've always loved. It's a little book, 85 pages long, called Lucky or Smart. And the entrepreneur is a guy named Bo Peabody. And he talks about how everybody wants to work for an organization that is fundamentally innovative, morally compelling, and philosophically positive. And I think that we're seeing this in the way multinationals today and companies are finding it difficult to, you know, the high rate of turnover of employees. People want to work for a company that is more than just padding their pockets, you know? They want to work for a company that's really got values that are driving it beyond just shareholder value. And that's a tough call for these companies when they're public because of the fact that they are pressured by those quarterly returns. Oddly enough, I remember one particular World Economic Forum annual meeting at Davos, there was a fascinating session that was called The Tyranny of the Market. And one founder of a public company talked about how he had delisted his company because he could not do the kinds of reforms that needed to get done within his company if he was public, because he wasn't going to be able to. So I find these, that the positive side, extremely compelling from the point of view of how attractive it is, you know, and how excited people get by the promise that something can be different.
Well, it's exciting work you're doing, Pamela. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
No, thank you very much. It was fun.
Pamela Hartigan is the author of the book, The Power of Unreasonable People, and co-founder of Volans, a venture company dedicated to nurturing solutions to poverty, sustainability, and disease. For a link to the book, go to our website, smartcityradio.com. Once again, Walker Smith has his ear to the ground of pop culture and the culture at large. A television show got our City Views commentator thinking about the difference between flipping channels and flipping houses.
I think back to the heyday of the recent real estate boom just a few years ago, and I can remember the very first appearances of all the reality TV shows about flipping houses and turning a fast buck in the real estate market. It occurs to me only now that there were no shows about building communities and neighborhoods, only shows about getting rich in real estate. I guess that's because flipping houses is entertainment, while building communities is work. And TV only cares about entertainment. It's no fault of TV. It's just an insight into what we were thinking back then. It's a different story these days, though. The news is brim full of reports about communities in trouble because of abandoned houses, foreclosures, unfinished developments, and shrinking tax bases. All of a sudden, we care about communities because we have discovered what flipping houses does to the communities we need in our lives. The macroeconomic effects of the housing meltdown are playing out in the stock market. These are serious problems, but sooner or later they will be contained. The micro-lifestyle effects of the housing crisis, however, are playing out on a much smaller stage, unnoticed by most people, and with personal effects hidden from view. What flipping houses has done to our communities will take a lot longer just to get recognized, much less fixed. This is the enduring damage that our binging on real estate has done to our quality of life. Unbridled greed is toxic and corrosive. Not that this is anything new. All the world's great philosophies and religions inveigh against it. The Ten Commandments, for example, are prescriptions against the different forms of greed and taking that tempt us. Selfishness, to any degree, is self-absorbed and narcissistic. Celebrating it in pop culture as the pinnacle of success and accomplishment is one step on a slippery slope that can take us over the edge, as indeed we are now seeing in real life over the past several months. There is a way back from this precipice, though. Not that we can turn building communities into entertainment suitable for TV, but we can change the character of demand in the marketplace. We can change the definition of success and accomplishment. Markets respond to what we want and what we are willing to buy, and right now, markets are looking to see what we will want and buy next. Our decisions will define the next tranche of investment opportunities. We won't be flipping very many houses anytime soon anyway, so now we can focus on community building without the overweening distraction of a real estate bubble. It's good for us, and it's good for the markets. And we don't have to undertake this as a mission. We only need to do this in our ordinary lives, which is what it should be to begin with. Flipping houses isn't any way to live. That's what communities are all about. And we need a lot more of that these days. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His latest book is Generation Ageless. Have you been to our website at smartcityradio.com? You'll find links to our guest work, an archive of all of our shows, and a way to get in touch with us. Click on the contact link or send us an email at questions@smartcityradio.com and let us know what you think of the show. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer because he's colorblind. Scotty, that doesn't make any sense. I'm Carol Coletta.